The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 79.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He's someone that I've really looked forward to talking to for a long time. He is an oil expert. His name is Art Berman. Art, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Well, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, for my viewers who might not know your backstory, can you get us up to speed there?
Sure. I'm a petroleum geologist. I have worked in the oil business for 40 plus years, worked for a big major oil company for the first 20, and I've been an independent consultant ever since. I do a fair amount of writing and speaking. Gets me in a lot of trouble, but it's kind of fun to, you know, to put my ideas out there. So that's basically what I do. But I am a, you know, I'm not a pundit. I'm not an op-ed guy. I actually work in the business, and most of my work is doing, you know, real exploration and production work and advising my clients who are all over the place, but a lot of them are in the financial sector, manage money, funds, and but also an awful lot of should we take this prospect, or should we pass on it? So economics, oil and gas, money, you know, it's all, I mean, oil, as you know, my fundamental tenet is oil is the economy. Right. So it's difficult to be an oil guy and be ignorant of the economy and, you know, all of that stuff. So I'm certainly not an economist, but compared to some geologists, I have a little bit more understanding.
Yeah, I think you're pretty good when it comes to that area for sure. I first met you 2019, January. We were both up at Macro Voices Live in Vancouver, Canada. Mm-hmm. And I remember you gave a talk up there, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, or a presentation. Mm-hmm. And that was extremely fascinating. I don't know if you recall your presentation. I was just wondering if you could give the viewers kind of a summary of that.
Right. So what I was doing at the time was providing some insight into, you know, basically how to short the oil market. Now, I'm not a financial advisor, and you know, I'm not really even all that much into commodities, but I pay attention to them, and what I shared was the methodology that I use to understand oil and gas price formation, and it's something that's called comparative inventory. I didn't invent it, but it basically looks at where we are on storage compared to the five-year average, and then I cross-plot that against price and develop what's called a yield curve, which really isn't all that different from a bond yield curve, except instead of looking at interest rates and maturities, you're looking at oil price and comparative inventory. And it's an incredibly powerful tool that most people are unaware of, although you can find five-year averages in all published data. People sort of understand the margins of it, but in any event, the importance, like right now, oil prices are super low, and according to my work, they're about $20 underpriced relative to this comparative inventory yield curve. Well, you know, that's worth knowing, because what it says is that we are in an extreme price discovery excursion. These happen more often than most people want to acknowledge. And so if you know you're in one of those excursions, basically the only place for price to go is up. Now, that doesn't mean it won't go down in the meantime.
Right.
But, you know, with that kind of firm knowledge, it really helps you to, you know, to understand where you want to be in this market if you're an investor, or if you're, just an economist. So, you know, I can look at oil consumption or demand, and I can tell you a lot about where the global economy is going. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, GDP, global GDP will be approximately 20% lower in 2020. I don't do any kind of fancy math or algorithms. I look at oil fundamentals because oil is the basis of the economy. And right. Some people think I'm probably kind of in the middle. If you look at all the investment bank estimates, you know, they range all the way up to 40%. But point being that, I mean, oil for most of your listeners is probably not their principal interest or concern, but it underlies everything in our, both our economy and really even in our society. So yeah. They don't need to learn about it, but you know, they can rely on people who do if they're inclined to use it as a, you know, a measure or an indicator in their investment life.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that Jeff Snyder said, and he was another individual that was up at Macro Voices Live, and he was using oil as a proxy, just like you're saying, because it's one of the very few things that the Fed can't manipulate the price to a certain extent. You know, they're in all these other markets, like the stock market or the bond market or the junk debt market, and they're really manipulating or trying to manipulate things. They're trying to put a floor on prices. But in the oil market, he was saying it's much more of a real type of price. There's more price discovery. And that was kind of his angle. Do you see it that way as well?
The only difference I would have with Jeffrey is I would say the economy is a proxy for oil instead of the other way around. And if you recall, when we had the panel discussion on stage, of which, you know, both Jeff and I were a part of, I was the only person up there that wasn't an economist.
Right. <banker. laughs> Well, and Jeff technically isn't an economist either, but he knows thousand times more than any economist. That's for sure.
That's true. But the, you know, I listened to everybody before I spoke intentionally. And then I gave them, you know, a good natured hard time about how they had each summarize what they had spoken about and learned during the several days of that conference, and not one of them had mentioned oil in that summary.
Right.
And to me, that's both, it's not really a criticism, it's an observation, but the, you know, the economists don't typically consider the availability and the cost of natural resources except as, you know, sort of a secondary kind of consideration. It's not primary in their analysis. And again, I'm not an economist, nor am I criticizing them. I'm just saying that if you're looking for a reason why a lot of the economic forecasts don't work, I would suggest starting there.
Yeah, so why should the average person start with oil? I mean, above and beyond the obvious.
Yeah, certainly. So most people think the economy runs on money, and that's completely untrue. Every organism on Earth relies on energy to live, and for humans, it's pretty basic. We need food to eat so we can live, and we have to expend energy to get that food. And so, in more primitive times, it was, you know, hey George, you know, getting a little low here on food supply. We better go out and hunt.
Right.
And so a bunch of us go out and we walk and we run and we shoot bows and arrows or throw spears or rocks or whatever we have, and, you know, basically use up a lot of energy, and hopefully we come back with, you know, a big kill so that we and our tribe, family can eat for, you know, a couple of weeks. And so the question is, in a subsistence society, the energy output to go kill and dress and store and eat the food is about equal to the energy input. And what happened as civilization developed is that we found ways of actually developing a surplus energy. And so, you know, agriculture, and you know, we can have a long discussion about whether the agricultural revolution was on balance positive for humans or not, but it doesn't really matter. Agriculture allowed us to produce more than we needed. And right. So in that particular case, then, because I got a barn full of grain, I may not want to do some work. And I'd say, hey, George, you know, I need to dig a ditch. And I'll tell you what, if you do the work for me, I will pay you with a couple of bushels of grain. And so so we ended up, but really the transaction is not in grain, it's in work. You do work, physical work, you expend calories or joules, and I will give you in return something that replenishes your calorie or joules. So fast forward to the present, and money is nothing more than a claim on energy. All of the financial investments that are made, the debt and whatever, it's a claim on assets of some sort. And so when we go into debt, personally, if I need to borrow money, basically, well, how do I pay the money back? I pay the money back by my work. I expend calories, and some of that may be just in my brain these days, but still, I do work, physical work of some sort, to get money, which is a proxy for work. And I pay, if I borrowed from you, I pay you back in the money, but we're really transacting energy when you get right down to it.
That's fascinating, because I always see it as we're transacting productivity, but you're taking it a step even further, saying you're actually talking about energy, because without the energy, you can't have the productivity in the first place.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that point up, because that's where I was going next. So there's a lot of sources of energy in the world, including just physical labor, or, you know, get a horse or a cow or an ox or something and use its physical labor. But in our world today, the most productive source of energy is oil. And right. So a barrel of oil, if you convert it to kilocalories or, you know, some other form of energy, and do all the calculation for, you know, how many days a week do I work, and et cetera, works out to be at 4.5 years of human labor in a barrel of oil. Wow. Now that's a huge bang for the buck.
Right.
So a really important point that most people don't think about is, what's the difference between price, cost, and value? And most of us use those kind of interchangeably, but let's talk about a barrel of oil. So the price of a barrel of oil today is about $25, roughly. The cost of a barrel of oil, which is what does it cost to actually get it out of the ground, is about $60 a barrel. The value of a barrel of oil is the work that it contains. So if we say that the median income of an American worker is $26,000 a year, then the value of a barrel of oil is like $120,000.
Right.
So these three things, price, cost, and value, are very, very different. And you cannot find any other source of energy that's got a multiple of, you know, like $25 price to $120,000 value. And that's why energy is the economy and oil is the most productive form of energy. Therefore, money is nothing more than a claim on oil. When right. you get right down to it, or some other form of less productive energy. So when I hear people talk about, oh, well, we're going to go to an all renewable economy, hey, I'm all for it. But let's understand that the bang for your buck, the energy density of solar or wind, is a fraction of oil. The value of a unit of energy produced from solar or wind is, you know, like maybe 10% of what's in a barrel of oil. So if you're good with that, if you're willing to run a society that has 90% lower productivity, if you want to think about it that way, that's just great. Let's do it. But it's going to be a poor world, a very poor world on 100% renewables. And again, I'm all for renewables. I'm not, you know, I'm all for all energy. I'm just saying, let's understand what you're really talking about here, because most people don't really understand what they're talking about here.
So let's just go ahead and piss off everyone that's watching this right now, Art, and just dive into the renewable stuff. But so I guess the rebuttal from someone might be, okay, Art, well, that's the technology as it exists right now. But is there a possibility for technology to improve to the point where wind, solar, electricity in general could be as efficient as oil, or is it just physically not possible?
Well, since we're going to piss people off, the answer is no.
Right.
Because technology doesn't create energy.
Right.
All technology is a way to convert energy into work. Mm-hmm. It's just that simple. Okay. So you can do whatever you want. And again, I'm a huge technology fan or freak. I mean, you know, all the work I do, I don't have a staff. I do it all myself. Well, how do I do that? Well, I use a lot of data, a lot of computers, a lot of computational power. And, you know, maybe I'm fooling myself. But so I'm 100%, you know, one of the biggest fans of technology. But let's understand what it is and what it isn't. You don't produce energy with technology. Right. You convert energy into work with technology, and it's not free. And so you get better technology. You know, we're talking to each other a couple of thousand miles away across the internet. Well, you know, that's not free. I mean, we're doing this on Skype, which doesn't cost you or I any money today. But you know, what's Skype? I mean, Skype is making money off this somehow. They're selling data. Okay, so there's a transaction that's going on here, and all of the, you know, all of the electricity that's generated to do this, and all the servers, you know, whether they're in the cloud or wherever they are. I mean, it's a huge amount of energy that is being expended every moment so that we can have this conversation from the United States to where you are in Colombia. So, you know, you can't, I mean, you can ignore it. But you shouldn't, because it's real. So, you know, let's talk about oil again, since that's what I know.
Yeah. And
of course, you know, the so-called shale revolution.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean it's with us forever. It's important. It has tremendous value. I've been a critic of its cost, which I continue to be. It's it costs more than the price, and that's very true today. So as a business investment, it's not super. But that's another subject. But you know, we talk about, well, it's all this technology, you know, it's the horizontal drilling and the hydraulic fracturing, and God, aren't we just amazing that we're able to do all this stuff? Yeah, but what does it cost?
Right.
So, you know, we drill if I drill a well, you know, in one of the, you know, the Permian Basin or the Bakken Shale or the Eagle, if I just drill a vertical well down to that formation, you know, and produce it, it's going to cost me like $1 million or $1.5 million, something like that. If I do all the fancy schmancy technology, the horizontal drilling and the hydraulic fracturing and all that, now we're talking about $10 million. So I better get a buzz from, you know, a 7 to 10x increase in my investment. It right. better be spectacular, because the net present value of it, I mean, I just dropped $10 million.
Right.
And I'm not getting any of that back until I get all this work done. And if that well isn't 10 times better than a vertical well, I'm screwed. So we treat this technology like, oh, it's cool and it's free, but it's not. It never is.
And it most likely would only be possible, like, ironically enough, like Tesla and Uber, it's only possible because the Fed has dropped interest rates to zero or almost zero for, call it, 10, 12 years. So you have all this money out there that's chasing a return because they can't get it with a treasury. So they go further and further and further out the risk curve to try to find some sort of yield. And that money ends up in shale. It ends up in Tesla. It ends up in WeWork, these types of companies.
Fair enough. And that's true. At the same time, though, there are a lot of people who say, oh, well, you know, shale never would have happened if it weren't for easy money. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, low interest rates were an important factor. But the big factor, the elephant in the room, to use a cliche, was oil price.
Right, right.
I mean, it was the fact that oil price was over $100 a barrel in today's money for 4 years straight. That's what really caused people to say, hey, know, we could probably do something at a price like that that we couldn't do at a lower price. And why was oil $100 a barrel for all that time? And really, since, you know, it goes back farther, back to, you know, 2004, 2005, is when the real price of oil started going up. It's because the resource was getting scarcer. It's just real simple. And right. So markets are practical things. They're not perfect. They even make mistakes, because markets are you and markets are me, and we're just people and we get things wrong. But one thing markets get right is how to provide leverage. And if you want somebody to drill more oil, to figure out new technology to get oil when you can't find it from ordinary means, boost the price.
You're right.
And right. Keep it higher for a while and watch what happens. It's just or look at what's going on right now. The inverse. So right. we have too much oil in the world. And so we went from, you know, say $50 a barrel a month and a half ago to actually negative prices 3 weeks ago. And now we've kind of worked our way back, and we're celebrating. Oh my God, it's a rally. We're at 25 friggin' dollars. So we went from, you know, so we're celebrating that we've recovered, you know, back to half the value, half the price of oil a month and a half ago. But,
right.
But
not only that, we're celebrating because we got to half the price, but we're still, call it, $35 under the cost of production.
At least. Yeah, it's just absolutely nuts. But the point of all this is that a month ago, people were saying, oh my God, you know, storage is going to get full because, you know, people can't, there's no place to put it. And they're just going to keep on producing and producing and producing because that's what they do. And a few of us, I mean, I publish charts, you know, every week and show, well, you know, how much farther do we have to go until storage is full? And I've said in interviews like this, I don't know, but we've never been full before. And I'd be willing to put a 50-50 bet on the fact that we don't get there this time either. And that's the way it's looking now.
So how did we get to negative 40 if there was capacity there for storage?
Because it was leased. Okay, so
all right. Right.
You know, you can reserve, tickets to, you know, to go see some, you know, go see the Beatles or somebody at a concert, and you don't have to go.
Right, right.
But somebody's waiting outside trying to get in, and there's no tickets available because you paid for the seats. And so all the storage is leased. And so the net, and again, you know, there, it got to negative 40 by, you know, kind of a technicality, a fluke of the way that futures markets work. And, you know, let's not bore everybody with that. The point is that the market was sending the strongest signal possible to producers to shut this stuff down, man.
Right.
Do you get it yet?
Yeah.
You know, do you get that you're going to have to pay more than the price of oil, than you could sell a barrel of oil for yesterday to make somebody take this? Is that strong enough for you? And guess what? It worked. I mean, the rate of shutting in production has been breathtaking. And the International Energy Agency just today said, oh, wow, we are so surprised at how quickly. And that's because the people that staff and run these agencies, they're smart people, but not a one of them. Let's say hardly a one of them has ever worked in this business.
Right.
They're not geologists, geophysicists, or engineers, and they've never worked in the oil and gas business. And so they don't know, or some people say, well, gee, why is it so hard to shut in a well, taking the other view? Well, that's because they don't get it. I mean, you drill a well, and it's never just Art that's drilling the well. I got partners.
Yeah.
And I have obligations to my partners. I have an agreement, a contract. And if I want to shut in a well, I got to send all my partners a letter. And they got 30 days to respond and tell me if they agree. And, you could say that's, usually that's fine. In this situation, that was too slow. But bottom line is markets are efficient. They're ruthlessly efficient. In fact, they typically short everything when they can. And production, I think that U.S. production will probably be less than 6 million barrels by the end of next month. And that's down from 13.
And what's the historic norm? For the last 5 years, say.
Probably 10, 11 million.
Okay.
A day. So it's a huge drop, and it's forced by the fact that if you produce the oil and you don't have storage leased, you're going to put it on the ground.
Yeah.
Or you're going to pay somebody who does have storage leased to take it.
And so the bottom line there, Art, is you think that the reduction in supply for the next 6 months will definitely outpace the reduction in potential demand?
I don't know that. That's the bet that certainly OPEC is making. That's the bet that most analysts are making, that if you look at their forecasts and do the hard work that I do, that I don't get paid any money for usually. That's I guess I need to pay more attention to what the economy is. But most forecasters are saying that we're going to be at a supply demand deficit by the end of this year. I think that's, well, I won't say anything's impossible. I think that's improbable. But fair enough. So that's the bet. The bet is that, demand's way down and there's not a heck of a lot you can do about that other than waiting for things to start up and hoping that people go back to spending the way they did before, which they won't. But that's another subject altogether. But, it doesn't matter. Markets don't really care. Markets don't care about supply, demand, the specifics. They ultimately care about, is there enough supply to meet the demand? Right? They don't care what the number is. And if demand is down, 20 million barrels a day, as long as supply is down 20 million barrels a day, markets are saying, hey, that's cool.
Right.
We'll put the price back closer to where it ought to be. Not any closer than we have to because we're cheap bastards, but we will let the price increase, back to something approaching whatever normal is. And yeah. So the issue fundamentally is that people, humans, me, you, we always want to blame somebody. There has to be a reason for everything, right? And usually if it's affecting me negatively, it's got to be like some conspiracy or something like that. And so, it's the Saudis, they're bad. They're trying to hurt us. It's, they're trying to kill the shale business. I mean, how unpatriotic of them. And, all this stuff. I guess I take a much more simplistic view of it. Those are silly humans trying to explain things in ways that make them feel better. The reality is much less interesting.
Right.
and a whole lot simpler too. The reality is that the world has been on OPEC plus life support for 4 years. OPEC has been withholding, you know, 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day from the market since late 2016. Mm-hmm. And we want to forget about that. We want to say, oh, everything's great. You know, price is going to go to $70 or $75 as it did in late 2018. Isn't that just wonderful? And then somebody bombs, the most important refinery in the world in Saudi Arabia. And 3 days later, the markets are yawning and saying, wow, why didn't price go up? Again, because markets aren't stupid. Markets say, you know, those guys have been holding off 1.8 million barrels a day. I mean, multiply 1.8 million barrels a day times 365 days of the year, and you got billions of barrels. Hey, yeah. The supply is there, guys. We're just not all that worried about it. And so people say, gosh, you know, this is so weird. Well, no, it's not weird. And so we got a market that's on life support. And the reality is that managed markets just don't work very well. I mean, you can argue that free markets may not work all that well either. But managed markets, you know, you can manage a market for a short period of time, as OPEC did right after the financial collapse in 2008. But you try to manage the market for 4 years, and I promise you something's going to get screwed up. And so we got a world that produces more oil than we need. I mean, that's the boring truth. It's not because of bad guys. It's not because of good guys. It's because of the fact that we're all in debt because we borrowed as a civilization against future energy surplus. We brought that supply forward into the future with something called debt. And the debt doesn't go away. And it comes back and it burns us every time. And that's the history. The history of the 20th century is that we ran out of surplus energy sometime in the 1970s or 1980s. And we figured out that debt was a really good way to pull that future surplus forward, pretend like we're producing it today, and party like it's 1999.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page.
Can you unpack that a little bit? Because I think that's going to be a rather complex concept for most people to really digest quickly. So you're saying that we ran out of excess supply back in the 80s, but we have fooled ourselves into thinking that everything is okay because currently through debt, we're bringing future supply into the equation today. So how does that work? I want to try to explain that for most people.
Well, it's just like a loan that I don't have enough money to to finance my extravagant lifestyle. And so I go to you and I say, gee, George, you're a rich guy. Why don't you lend me the $100,000 that I need to, you know, buy myself a fancy car and buy myself a fancy house and take a few fancy vacations so that I feel like I'm living high off the proverbial hog. And so ordinarily I would have to work my ass off
right.
for years and years and years to save the money to be able to do all those things. But I want them now.
Right.
So I'm going to pull those future consumptions of things, of air travel and housing and, you know, cars. I'm going to pull that from the future, all my future work that I'm not going to do now. I'm going to pull my consumption of all that into the present by borrowing money from you.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So these oil producers, instead of expanding through profits, they expanded through debt.
Correct. And so it feels great. I'm going out of business like crazy, but it sure feels great. and we've been doing that as a civilization, but certainly in the United States, the lion of American presidents is Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan somehow delivered us. You know, he figured out how to take a crappy economy where inflation was going berserk, and we had stagflation and all that kind of crap. And he didn't figure it out himself because he didn't know how to do it. But he had a guy named Paul Volcker,
right,
who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who said, well, you know, we could raise interest rates to like 18%. And that'd sure as hell kill inflation. And it sure as hell did. But not only that, but it made the United States Treasury the preferred asset of the universe. I mean, why in the world would you invest in anything if you could get 18% on a T-bond, for crying out loud? And that's what the world did. And the money just poured into the United States Treasury. And we used all that money to buy a future, to bring forward our consumption. So we were the guy who borrowed from George and got a Maserati and a fancy house and took a trip around the world. Except at some point, you got to pay it back, theoretically, very theoretically, in the case of global economies. But that was the dilemma that the world faced in 2008, that, you know, basically the invoice had come and we didn't quite know what to do with it. And so we borrowed more. Right. And I'm not criticizing it. I'm not criticizing it at all. In fact, it fascinates me, you know, to watch all the right wing and the left wing economic camps. And boy, you know, when things are going pretty well or not too badly, the more conservative economists, they just love to bash, you know, good old John Maynard Keynes.
Yeah.
But whenever there's a crisis, holy cow.
Everybody's Keynesian now.
Oh, man, we're stimulating and we're quantitatively easing and we're printing money like nobody's business. Okay. And because, you know, I'm not taking sides on it. I just find it, I think it's really funny that you know, we bash the guy relentlessly. But when we're in trouble, you know, it's like God.
Yeah,
we don't need God until I'm in a foxhole. And then I start praying. Pray to Keynes. Maybe he can help.
Yeah, that's right. I think now they're taking it a step further with MMT. I mean, they meaning the politicians and the political narrative. I think it was Keynes. Now it's just flat out MMT, helicopter money, whatever you want to call it. But going back to the oil topic, man, this is just so interesting. So I'm trying to circle back to the last 4 years when you were saying that there's excess supply out there, that they're just not accessing to artificially prop up the price. So we as the layman see the price of oil and say, well, the economy is probably not doing too bad and everything seems to be good because oil's up near, call it $60, $70 a barrel. But they're not considering the fact that there's all this supply that could come onto the market that's being artificially held back. So is the result of that, that the economy just isn't doing as well as we think it is? Or is it a result of the excessive debts you were talking about?
Well, it's all of the above. Again, I mean, it all goes back to work, and you know, and whether the work is done in the present or borrowed from the future. The point, I guess, is that if you look at, you know, the period of say $60 or $65 oil, using say 2018 as an example. how does that price compare to the price in, say, 2000? And the answer is it's about 40% higher in constant dollars.
Right.
So if your underlying cost of doing business increases by 40%, what's the likelihood that your business is going to be okay? I mean, I don't know what kind of business, you know, unless you're in organized crime or something like that, you're going to face a real big challenge.
Yeah.
Doing as well as you were in 2000, if your underlying cost of doing business went up by, 30 or 40%.
Yeah.
And so we make ourselves feel better by borrowing more. And every president in the United States since Ronald Reagan and a few before him, but it really took off. I mean, U.S. GDP exceeded, debt, U.S. total debt exceeded GDP in 1986. Fact. Download the data, prove it to yourself. And I think most economists, most people would say, gee, that's a bad thing. And so it's only gotten worse. And every president has done it. And that's because they had to, because once it's an addiction. And once you get used to living what seems like better, you can't tell people no.
Yeah.
And so now we find ourselves in a situation where you don't have to tell people no, it's just no. The universe is saying no. And we face a situation now where the living standard of many people is already way below what it was just a few months ago. And that is not going to get better. And it's going to affect us all. And I don't mean to be a Cassandra or anything here, but the invoice was due in 2008 and we borrowed big time on a balloon payment to make it feel better or make it seem better. And of course this virus was obviously not something, and to say it was unexpected, it was unexpected when it would happen. I don't think anybody that bothers to read or pay attention would have thought that something like this was unexpected. It was expected. It's just we don't know when it's going to happen and we don't know how bad it's going to be. But fair enough. I mean, the virus was a factor that wasn't part of the equation when we took out the loan. But that often is the case. You take out a loan, you lose your job. Well, you didn't think that was going to happen, but there it is. And
exactly.
So now we're in a situation where if we manage to get through this hole as an economy, and I certainly, I don't know what hole means. It'll be, let's say if we get through this half or 70%, how's that going to work?
Yeah.
And at the very least, the amount of devaluation of our currencies is going to be extreme.
I'm sorry to butt in here, Art, but I just want to explain for the viewers. Basically, what you're saying is that the economy or the person using it, just as a household type of balance sheet, they're over indebted. The fundamentals of the household balance sheet is not good. And that you're just barely getting by, even if you have a good job. So once you get fired or you get laid off, now all of a sudden you've got big, big problems. But the big problem isn't necessarily that you got laid off. The even bigger problem is that you had a horrible balance sheet and you were fundamentally unsound to begin with. And I think that's the analogy that you're using with the economy. Yes, the virus is a problem, but the big problem is the underlying fundamentals of the economy are very poor, especially when you look at the amount of debt that we have in the system, not only at the sovereign level, but at the state level, at the consumer level, at the corporate level. I mean, you look anywhere and debt is at all-time highs.
That's perfect way to summarize it. That's exactly the way I would have done it.
I'll just ask a personal question here. And, I look at investing in 5 years, 10 years plus. So for me, I'm really curious as to what the price of oil is doing, not necessarily in the next 2 weeks or the next 2 months, but the next 10 years. So what are your thoughts there?
Right. Excellent question. And the answer is, beats me. I mean, who knows the answers to those questions? But I'll speculate, because that's what we're here to do.
Right.
And hopefully we don't piss off any more people than we already have.
Oh, it doesn't matter. My viewers are accustomed to me pissing them off, frequently.
I piss people off all the time, and they take great offense at it, but just trying to tell the truth as I see it.
That's important. That's right.
I'm not a contrarian. I don't dream up things to say that'll be controversial. I look at the data, and if that's what the data tells me, that's what I say. Doesn't mean I'm right. But so where's oil going? I think that it's very clear. It's clear to me that the 2018 was probably. I'd be shocked if we get back to oil production levels that we saw in the third, fourth quarter of 2018. And I would be equally surprised if the economy of the United States or the world gets back to those levels. So, you know, there are a lot of arguments that people make. Well, we're not investing in oil infrastructure, you know, it's all about the present, and gee, all these shale wells, they decline like, you know, gangbusters, and that's going to come back and bite us in the ass. And yeah, all that's true. All that's absolutely true. But the other thing that's true is, yeah, man, but we got way too much oil.
Right.
And you know, without getting into, you know, why that is, let me say that somewhere out there, in your time horizon of 5 or 10 years, there probably will not be as much oil. There probably won't be too much oil. Let's put it that way. And if that's the case, then the price will go up. And if the price goes up, even in a reasonably sound economy, that's difficult for the average person to make money. In a fragile economy, that can be disastrous. So the long-term picture, well, it's even the short-term picture. I mean, if somebody asked me where the price of oil is going to go in the next 6 months or a year, I would say it's got only one place to go, and that's up. Now, sentiment and all sorts of other factors are going to create, you know, proverbial bumps in the road. I mean, it's not going to be a straight line. And while we're talking about it, I would be surprised if oil doesn't go back to sub $20 levels or even down to $10 at some point when people get really bummed out about how crappy the economy is. I mean, that's, right. You know, we are humans. We have moods and market sentiment and the price discovery that goes along with it is going to reflect that. But I started out a while ago saying that the oil is underpriced by $20 roughly right now. Okay, so if that's the truth, then it's got to go up. It's got to go up. Now,
it
how
still doesn't have to go up to 75.
Oh, no. I mean, I think the correct price of oil, if there is such a thing, based on comparative inventory, it's about $40 for WTI and about $45 for Brent. That is the balance between comparative inventory and price. And what I see there, if you look at these yield curves, the curvature of the yield curve, and again, for those of you that can't picture it, I mean, you know, if you're looking at bonds, you can imagine that if that yield curve is curved, then that means that a little bit of a change in something like interest rate can make a big change in the value at the end of the cycle. If it's pretty flat, then basically it doesn't matter. That it's a safe investment. You're not going to lose any money, but you're probably not going to make any either. And where we are with oil right now is we're on a super flat yield curve. And so people say, gee, why did price go down so fast? And so far, I mean, farther than it's ever been in, you know, any kind of recent historical time, because the yield curve got flattened. And so, you know, you can pile up a mountain of storage beyond what we have today, and the price doesn't go down hardly at all. Or you can draw down a whole bunch of storage. And you go to the other side of the curve and the price doesn't go up very much because the yield curve is flat. So the point is that once we reach that yield curve, so there's a big potential over the next year and a half or two that if you go long on oil, that you will win. And if you look at the stock prices of the, you know, any of the major oil companies or major independents, Chevron, Exxon, Conoco, Diamondback, Concho, you know, name your EOG, those companies' share price have appreciated, you know, something like 35% since a month ago. Mm-hmm. Because oil prices have gone up. I mean, it's not rocket science that the price of a share price of an oil company has a very good correlation to the price of oil.
Right.
So that's something to think about. Longer term, as I've said, I mean, in any scenario, we hear a lot about peak demand and, you know, all this kind of, you know, what I consider to be, sort of silly conversations in the hot tub at the Esalen Institute or something like that. I mean, it's like, really, guys, I mean, who cares? But okay. You know, that's a topic. All right. But the reality is that it's not about demand. It's not about supply. Inventory is in the middle, but really it's about energy and how that interacts with the economy and all those little pieces. You know, well, let's stop talking about oil. Let's talk about football. Oh, okay. Let's shift gears. Well, you know, you can do that on a matter of personal interest, but you can't do that about oil, really. We can stop talking about it, but, you know, the football season isn't going to happen because the economy sucks and there's a virus and a lot of other things like that. So the problem with oil is that everything depends on it. So the future of oil price is good. The future of oil cost is not good because it already has increased and we've squandered a tremendous amount of oil at terrible prices. We've basically dumped, you know, billions of barrels of oil produced from shale onto a market that wasn't willing to pay us what it cost us.
Yeah, future supply, to your earlier point.
Exactly. And so when we actually need the stuff, then the best stuff is going to, you know, it's already been picked. And so what's left is going to cost even more to extract. So, you know, you want to be long on oil. Long on oil is a good bet, but be careful how you choose to go at it. So if you invest in an oil company that won't exist in 6 months, you know, you need to think about that. You want to put some money in Chevron, that's probably safe. But I think that many, well, I mean, Scott Sheffield, who is not exactly, my mentor, but sometimes he says the right thing. He's the CEO of Pioneer Resources. He says, you know, there's only going to be 10 independents left by the end of 2021. And that's because of what you said, their balance sheets. These are companies that have huge debt, billions and billions of dollars. All or most of their production is either now shut in or is going to be shut in. So they have no revenue.
Right.
They have no means to pay their debt. They have no means to pay the interest. And that interest for some of those guys is, you know, like $2 or $3 a barrel. And so if they can't pay their debt, then they got to go bankrupt at some point. You know, maybe there'll be some forgiveness along the way. Maybe, you know, they'll forgive it for a few months. But eventually, you know, the creditors are there going to say, look, guys, you know, this is it. And so in a normal scenario, you say, well, okay, you know, that's too bad for XYZ company, but somebody else will buy them because it's a bargain. Well, not in this environment, because Shell has cut its dividend. Chevron, Exxon, BP are going to pay their dividends for now. They're being criticized by a lot of analysts for doing that because they don't have the money. And so an Exxon or a Chevron announces, oh, well, you know, we're going to go out and you know, buy XYZ, you know, crappy independent oil company at pennies on the dollar. Oh, by the way, we're going to take their $5 billion or $10 billion in debt along the way. And, you know, first of all, they don't have the money to do it. And, the shareholders are going to go berserker. You know, we don't need any more oil, guys, and you don't have the money to buy somebody else's crappy balance sheet. So I don't think that's going to happen. I may be wrong.
The government is going to bail out the crappy balance sheet?
How are they going to bail them out? Give them money? No, they're going to become the property of the government. Just like General Motors effectively, de facto, was owned by the United States government in 2009. You want to call it nationalized? Fine. You don't like that word? Sounds too much like socialism? Call it something else. I don't care. But that is what I think is going to happen. Now, it's not
okay. So you think these independents that in the United States, a lot of these shale producers will be just the equity, they'll be bailed out, or they'll be
wards of the government.
Yeah, right.
Oil is way too important.
Yeah.
To fail, if you will. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the corporate entity needs to continue to exist. But I mean, you know, even politicians who don't have the attention span for something as complex as oil. And you know, we've been talking now for a while, and I've tried to keep it simple, but it's obviously labyrinthine at best. Even they understand that there is some kind of relationship between productivity, global power, military power, and oil. Right. They get that. I mean, the United States won World War II for a very simple reason. We had better access to petroleum than our enemies did. Mm. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt understood that message very clearly. And that's why, as soon as he got done dividing up the world at Yalta with Churchill and Stalin, his next stop was an aircraft carrier in the Red Sea to talk to the King of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Most people don't know about that. But Roosevelt, I mean, this is at a time when the United States was 1,000% oil independent, produced 50-60% of the oil supply in the world. And we had a president with enough vision in 1945 to say, wow, this could be a real problem for our power, for our economic strength. We need to secure our oil supply way into the future.
Right, because he saw how integral it was to the war.
We would have lost the war. I mean, the Germans, I mean, they were figuring out how to make oil from coal, for crying out loud, because they just sucked. I mean, didn't have any oil. Japan still doesn't have any oil. Japan, the whole reason the United States got into World War II was because Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Why did they do it? Because they wanted to take Indonesia, because Indonesia had oil.
Right.
And there was a treaty between the United States and Holland, and they were worried that, you know, it's kind of silly when you think about it, that the United States might attack them for taking Indonesia. So they figured it was a good idea to attack us first, which, you know, good logic, I suppose. But nonetheless, I mean, see, it's just really hard to extricate resources in general, and oil in particular, from history, from world politics. I mean, the British had 1 million troops in what's now Iran before World War I. Wow, what were they doing there? Why in the world were there 1 million British troops in Iran? Well, Germany was about to build a railroad from Berlin to Baghdad. Mm. And the thing that started, that triggered World War I, the assassination of some archduke in Montenegro or something. What was that about? Well, because those funny little Serbian states didn't want to give Germany a right of way to build their damn railroad. And why did they want to build a railroad? Because they wanted to transport oil, for crying out loud. And so World War I, the trigger for it was right away on a railroad that would bring oil. And the British were anticipating, and they had troops in the Middle East, and nobody knows this stuff, okay? And I'm not trying to say this is the singular cause of World War One, but it was certainly a cause. And yeah. And you know, remember all those boats that the German submarines were sinking at the beginning of World War II? Remember that? You know, all those guys, those were all carrying coal. England was the Saudi Arabia of coal. And Germany was developing its coal industry because they didn't have any oil. And right. So, you know, you can keep turning the pages back and back and back. And what you realize is where we started this conversation, that energy is the economy. And today the economy is energy is oil. In previous decades, it was coal. It was wood before that. It was oxen and cattle before that.
Yeah, but Art, one thing I learned in a discussion with another hedge fund guy that I've got a ton of respect for is he said that the world, he was talking about coal in particular and oil, and he's saying the world has never gone from gone to a lesser dense energy source. It's always gone to a more dense. So like wood to coal, coal to oil. Is that accurate? And then how would that play? And I promise this is the last question I'll ask you, because I know you've been extremely generous with your time, but how does that play if we're talking about electricity in the future being a less dense energy source than oil? Wouldn't that be the first, if what he's saying is accurate, wouldn't that be the first time in world history that we've gone to a lower or a less dense source of energy?
Well, of course, because your hedge fund buddy stole that quote from me.
Oh.
Yeah, that's exactly okay. Where he got it. I've written that many times. I've stated it in many conferences.
It could be because I'm sure he's a big fan of yours.
Imitation so, yeah. And flattery and all of that. But yeah, of course. I mean, you look at human history and you know, it's always been to a more productive form of energy. I mean, that just kind of makes sense, doesn't it? And so now we're talking about, we want to go backward to, you know, to sun and wind. And again, I'm a big advocate. You know, I'm a conservationist. I'm an environmentalist. I have been my whole life. That's why I went into geology. I love the earth. I love the environment. So, but you know, at the same time, I'm a pragmatic guy. And humans have never gone ever because it's dumb. dumb in a genetic sense. I mean, just, you know, a caveman kind of thing. You know, should I do this or should I do that? Well, that's dumb. I wouldn't want to do that. Well, you want to do that maybe because you have to. Okay, that's another discussion altogether. And so, yeah, there are real implications. And so assuming we could just substitute, you know, so-called renewable energy, which is not renewable, it's rebuildable, which is different. You know, energy is energy, and there's an infinite amount of energy in the world, in the universe. We don't have access to it all at a price that we can afford. But nonetheless, bottom line is, if we could become a 100% renewable economy world, we would have a whole lot less productivity, and therefore we'd be a lot poorer.
Yeah, right. And you got to choose. It's one or the other. It's either, you know,
that may be a better thing for the world and for humanity and everything else. But you know, you got to know that before you make that decision. And unfortunately, I mean, everybody's promoting whatever they're selling, right? And so we like to demonize the people that are, you know, that are touting the benefits of coal or natural gas or oil. And we want to imagine that those people that are promoting solar and wind, that they're just all angelic. Well, they're not. They're promoting their business in the same way. And they're promoting an absolutely false idea that your life is going to be just like it is now, except you won't be burning nasty fossil energy.
Or it'll be better. It'll be better.
Well, maybe better. It'll just be poorer.
Well, I'm saying from their standpoint, that's what they're arguing. You know, it's not only is the energy source is better, your life will be better. You'll be actually more productive and more efficient if we go on to this renewable. And I think that's really the bottom line. Well, that's them arguing.
The physics don't work. No, the physics don't work.
Yeah, right.
The math doesn't work. I've got a recent post on my website just like a week ago or so, you know, why the renewable rocket has failed to launch. And that's it. That's exactly it. That you're being sold a story that you're going to be so pissed when you find out the ending to that story. You're going to say, wait a minute, who were those guys that told me my life was going to be just as good, if not better? Yeah, right. It's like, who were the guys that, you know, that cratered the economy in 2008? Well, you know, none of them are in jail, right? We're pissed.
Yeah. So really, the for investors, the bottom line, 10 years from now, it's you've got to make a choice, or a society has to make a choice. Either you accept the fact that oil is going to be the main source of energy, therefore price is most likely going up, or you've got to accept the fact that society is going to have a lower standard of living.
And we may not have much of a choice in that matter. And I read a lot of people right now saying, oh, what a great opportunity for green energy. You know, oil's in the toilet, and this is the time that we can really push forward, you know, peak demand, blah, blah, blah. And again, you know, read my post, but I think exactly the opposite. I think that when people are hurting for cash, global depression, we're going to choose the cheapest, most available, most productive form of everything that we can. You know, a month ago, I might not have wanted to buy, you know, the store brand of, you know, you name it, you know, coffee or toilet paper or whatever. But if I can't get, you know, Charmin, hey, I'll take whatever toilet paper is out there. And I might find out it's just as good and it's a whole lot cheaper.
Yeah, that's exactly been my argument that I've had for coal and other energy moving forward. As I said, listen, I understand the green argument, and I'm like you, I don't really care for breathing bad air, or, you know, I don't like that any more than anyone else does. But from a political standpoint or a social standpoint, if we've got unemployment at 20 or 25%, the last thing the politicians and most of the individuals in society are going to be worrying about is green energy. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying when you can't put food on the table, it's you got a Maslow's hierarchy of needs there. And I think that's what it boils down to.
We're humans, and we haven't figured out how to change our, you know, our real basic hunter-gatherer savanna emotional development.
Yeah.
And until we do, and we can make those intelligent choices, I think we're going to revert to the most basic instinctual genetic behavior that we can.
Yeah. A great example of that, Art, is just the United States compared to a country like Ecuador or something like that. And Ecuador, that would never fly, like not just green energy, but a poor country. You know, they have to have energy, or they're not putting food on the table. It's much more right at it's a talking point. It's right in their face that they don't have the luxury of thinking about green energy. And so my point is that the U.S. standard of living goes down because we have a depression or something, that's going to be our priority as well. But I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I know you got to walk your dog. This has just been a fantastic conversation. Man, I was really looking forward to it, but it exceeded even my most optimistic expectations. So thank you very much. Art, for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do or your research, where can they go?
ArtBerman.com. That's my website. There's an awful lot of free content out there. If you're interested in digging into some of the details, I've got a whole array of subscription products that the most expensive one will cost you $50 a month. And most of them, you can get one or two bundled for $20 a month. Some pretty big insights going on there. So that's artberman.com. I'm very active on Twitter at AEBerman12. You can, you know, I drop most of the important stuff out there, but, you know, you may
tons of charts too. I follow you on Twitter. and tons of really awesome, awesome charts.
But to understand them all and put them together, you may actually need to come to the website. You may even, depending on your need, most of it's free. But for those that are serious about the insight and the understanding, the kind of thing we're discussing right now, it doesn't cost much.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't recommend it enough. All right, Art, I appreciate it, and I can't wait to do it again.
Sounds great. Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.